today we welcome from the Animal Clinic of Kalispell, Dr. Jevin Clark.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah, good morning.
Before we dive into the topics we want to talk about, we have a couple of stories that I wanted to ask you about. One of them is Dupedoros Creek. There was 11 dogs that they found up there.
I just read that this morning. I don't know what's going on.
One of them has apparently, or now several of them have what they call a parvovirus.
Yeah.
What is that and how bad is it?
So parvovirus is a virus, gastrointestinal virus of dogs. Actually, pretty much every mammalian species has their own parvovirus. The one in dogs, it affects the small intestinal cells. So it kills off the surface intestinal cells. It's a virus that gets in there. And there's a couple of problems with the virus or the challenges. One is that the virus lives a extraordinarily long time in the environment, like years and years. Even here where it's cold in the wintertime, it does not kill it. So, and dogs that have parvo, when they're shedding that virus, it's like trillions of viral particles per gram of fecal material, which is a lot. And so it doesn't take very much. You know, you can have an exposure that you didn't even know about. You know, your next door neighbors went to their in-law's house and picked up some virus that was in their yard 5 years ago, and they bring it back on their shoes and come see your dog. The good news, so the way we manage it, parvovirus has actually changed quite a bit over the last 30 years. I mean, the virus changes just like everything else changes, and vaccines are incredibly effective. But the important part is to get dogs vaccinated at the right times. So, you know, if they're vaccinated too early, if puppies are vaccinated too early, their immune systems never see that vaccine. And so it doesn't work. When I say doesn't see it, the mother's antibodies kill the vaccine off before the puppy has a chance to actually respond to it. So that's why we wait until they're like 8 weeks old to start vaccines. Usually we do 8, 12, and 16 weeks. The vaccine is incredibly effective for dogs. Dogs that succumb to parvovirus or get it, the mortality rate can be, it varies. It can be pretty significant. Dogs that die from parvo usually die from dehydration. It's not the virus itself per se, it's the dehydration that it causes that really whacks them. Yeah, so
I read it was like a 91% mortality rate if they don't get treatment.
Yeah, I think that's probably relatively accurate. That might be a little bit high as far as literally every case is a little bit different because the virus is different in different parts of the country. It seems like our parvovirus up here, yes, we have it. It doesn't seem to be as severe as some other places in the country, but yes, we see dogs that come into the clinic that are parvo positive that are seemingly pretty darn healthy and they manage at home just fine. We have other dogs that are in the hospital for, 5 days. So.
And how do you treat it?
IV fluid therapy. It's all supportive care. So trying to get fluids so they don't get dehydrated. Antibiotics to try to prevent bacteria from their gut to translocate into their blood system. And hopefully get some nutrition in there. That's the really big challenge is getting a dog that's got really nasty vomiting and diarrhea that is total dump to get calories into them is challenging.
And then we also have the story of 100 cats that apparently were hoarded up in Whitefish, and they are being held at the animal shelter because, they're evidence. Just like these 11 dogs are being held there because they're evidence. How in the world, what's the mentality of people who want to collect cats?
I think that people that rescue animals, I think, honestly, they have a good heart. They're trying to do what they think is right to try to protect these animals or say, quote unquote, save them. But then it gets overwhelming that, and pretty soon, especially with cats, it just doesn't take long to go from controlled to, oh my gosh, look what's happening here. And talk about a challenge. Not only is it a challenge for the cats, but challenge for our shelter. You know, how do you care for that many pets that get dumped in the span of, a couple hours? It's not like they could predict that. So,
I have six that I feed.
Yeah.
Five that come in and out, and one that's outside looking in, he's a welfare cat out there. But, and I'm worried about him this winter. He's going to be wanting to make
but at least sneaking in.
The cost of food
would
be overwhelming for 100 for one person. That's... So are they really hoarding cats or they're just not getting them spayed and neutered?
Well, yes. I don't know. I think that part of both, I think, is that they just get out of control.
They love animals, and they just can't say no.
Right, they can't say no. They want to help.
And they're so cute when they're little.
They are. They're cute.
So that kind of leads us into the topic. Multiple cat households. Now, that's an extreme, but, you've got two or three cats in your home. Do they like to use the same cat box?
Yeah, that could be super challenging. I had the reason that I kind of thought about this yesterday. Well, actually, Robin should be talking about this segment, not me. I only have one cat in my house. But I had a client come in yesterday who has had a cat for 4 or 5 years, and they just changed their living situation and had somebody move in with them that's got a bunch of cats. So they went from one cat household to five. And this older, or this cat, this established cat, is like having a hard time. So the things that are challenging are, cats don't like change. They're good at hiding when they're sick, and they're good at being crabby, holding a grudge, Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you get cats that they're totally okay with each other, but other times it's like, okay, you take a cat that's lived by itself for 4 years and you dump four more cats in there. And so they were having the typical issues of, there's not enough litter boxes, and so one cat gets beat up when it's in the litter box, and all of a sudden that cat stops using the litter box. They're going out somewhere else, or they're, peeing on the furniture, or they're, going up in the bedroom and hiding out, or they're hiding under the bed, and they never used to do that. So cats in general can be challenging to introduce, because some cats just don't like change. And so if you're trying to introduce a new situation to a cat that's got this established routine, it can be super challenging.
Well, cats like their privacy when they go to the privy.
They do. And, interestingly, when we have, when we're talking with clients about litter box issues, like cats going outside the box, our nature as humans, we like to hide litter boxes because they're gross. We don't want to look at them.
Right.
But cats, actually, there's lots of good study data that they like litter boxes out in the open. Like, so instead of putting it in the corner or under a sink, they put it against the whole, the wall in the middle part of your wall out in your living room, somewhere where they can see what's happening, so they're not going to get ambushed. What the theory is that they think. So that's one of those things that's like, I don't want to look at a litter box, but that's where they like the placement, or different types of litter. There's all sorts of things to try to get them to curve back to the box.
One of the things from Miss Kitty, when we would have company, we would move the litter box to a different place, and she had any trouble finding it.
Yeah.
She knew exactly where
to go. She knew where it was.
Yeah, we didn't have to tell her.
Yeah, thank goodness she tolerated that.
We've all experienced cats holding a grudge. It's you go away for a couple of days and you leave hard food for them, and you come back and they think you can come back and just think it's all right.
Right?
Yeah. They're going to torture you for a while.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they do. They have that personality of like, okay, well, I'm glad you're back, but you didn't clear this on my schedule.
Now, you said something interesting about the litter box and the cats. We've got five of them who are inside, in the summertime, they are out a lot, but, and they all use the same litter box.
That's amazing. I mean, that's pretty unusual.
They've done that since they were young.
Yeah.
And so
they may have got used to it.
Yeah.
When we're having problems, like if cats are going outside the box, that's one of the behavioral things that the behaviorists talk about, is to add litter boxes. And what they recommend is one litter box per cat plus one, which that's a lot of litter boxes.
For visitors, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So it gets to be, there's not enough wall space in your house.
Well, I scoop it out every day and top it off with fresh litter. And
yeah.
Well, periodically change the drop thing that's under it.
Well, I noticed there are certain types of litter they say are good for multiple cats.
Yeah.
Are they really?
See, I bought into that.
I think so. There's some, they have some litters that have some pheromones in there that will kind of get released. So it just kind of takes the edge off. So that's another. Now, the flip side of that is I always warn people about using, especially like if you're cleaning up after your cats or dogs that have peed in the house or something, to avoid anything with a lot of perfume on it. Because some animals do not like that, and they'll pee because there's perfume there. So you want to use something, enzymatic cleaners that just break it down and don't have any perfumes in there.
Oh boy, Dr. Jevon Clark is our guest. That's enough about cats, dogs, dogs and back pain. Oh, right after this, our guest today is from the Kalispell Animal Clinic, Animal Clinic of Kalispell, Dr. Jevin Clark. Okay, dogs with back pain.
Yeah, we how see do you it know if all they, the time.
How do you know if a dog is having back pain?
Sometimes it's very easy. Sometimes, like especially if you have a certain breeds, you know, the typical dachshunds, beagles, basset hounds that most of the people that own those dogs know that they're kind of prone to having back or disc issues. Mm-hmm. One of the most common signs initially is either having a hunched up back, or especially dogs that are normally really busy and jumping and running, all of a sudden they don't want to do the stairs, or they always jump on the couch, and today they hesitated, like they sit there, mm-hmm. they don't want to do that, or it hurts to jump off the bed today. You know, they don't want to do those kind of normal routines that get thrown off. But sometimes it's really it's difficult. In fact, I got tricked yesterday. I had somebody come in with a big dog, so a dog like a husky that normally they aren't necessarily prone to back disease at any other higher rate than the other dog is. But they came in for something and they said, you know, she just doesn't feel right. And we kind of went down this, I started down this rabbit hole of, you know, is there something metabolic going on? And finally, at the end of the whole thing, she says, oh, my husband did notice that she was acting like she was limping the other day or sore the other day. And sure enough, she ended up after all that, then it's like, oh, well, maybe her back hurts. And that's why she was all dumpy. She just didn't want to move because her back was hurting.
Now, is this caused by some type of an accident, perhaps, or is there a disease involved?
It's usually disease and some genetics involved.
Arthritis with age?
Yes, but there's the two biggest things we see, the most common ones. So disc problems, so intervertebral disc disease, just like people get where you get a disc bulging into your spinal roots, and so that hurts to kind of move. That's probably the most common thing that we have in little dogs is disc disease, and what's called lumbosacral stenosis, or in people that's related to sciatic pain. And larger breed, any breed of dog can get that, but certainly larger breed dogs, we see that a lot where they get like spondylosis, which is a evidence of arthritis in their back, or where the discs are getting crunched right where the spine meets the pelvis. And so all those nerves that go to the back end just makes them inflamed, and then they get a little bit weak. So those big dogs, the 10-year-old lab that used to be able to jump in the truck, and then now as they've aged, we kind of chalk it up to, oh, he's just getting old. Well, in reality, it's probably that his back is a little sore. And so we do a lot of radiographs on lots of backs, and lots of big dogs have evidence of chronic back disease. So it's one of those things that can hide. Like I said, I got tricked yesterday going down one direction, and then at the end it's like, oh, this is something different. his back is sore. So, yeah.
And is there anything we can do for them?
Yeah. So as far as prevention, some of the things for those little dogs like dachshunds and bassets that are used, mm-hmm. that are pretty common to get disc problems, as much as possible, it's nice to keep their weight down. So weight reduction is the best thing to keep that back healthy. And then as much as possible, not letting them like just fly off the deck 1,000 miles an hour. You know, that's difficult because these dogs that hurt their backs are active dogs. So, mm-hmm. But certainly, you know, just reducing their activity in that way a little bit is good. And with big dogs, similar kinds of things, the larger dog ones, there's less prevention other than keeping their weight down and keeping them active, mm-hmm. you know, just having good, strong back muscles is good. So, you know, routine, just kind of having that in your normal lifestyle from the time the dog is young, you know, lots of good exercise, good quality exercise, and not getting old and fat.
What if it's caused by some type of trauma? Can it be repaired like men, like we do with humans?
Sure. Yeah, especially the disc disease. If they get a disc that's really explosive, that's pinched that spinal root, then yeah, those actually are surgical, and the surgical outcomes are pretty darn good for those. Normally, disc disease usually just causes just pain and a little bit of neurologic stuff, and most of those are medical. But sometimes if the neurological signs are getting worse, so if you have a dog that's maybe just a little bit slow or weak in the rear end, that progresses to, oh my gosh, now they're paralyzed in the back end, those are the dogs we have to make some just quick decisions on, you know, send them to surgery.
So the breeds are unique. You mentioned dachshunds and, you know, yes. the dogs that are long in body.
Right, long, short dogs.
Yeah. Now, what about disease like arthritis, which typically would occur later on? Are the actuarial tables life expectancy of the breeds differently?
Oh, sure. Most of the, some of the arthritis stuff is, you know, nature. So you have some genetics and some is nurture. So depending on what the dog's activity level has been like its whole life. But yeah, you know, the, generally speaking, I would say, you know, those larger dogs tend to get worse arthritis or more debilitating back arthritis than the small dogs do throughout their life. There are some other genetic diseases that we see that look like they're back related, but like a degenerative myelopathy is one that's fairly common in corgis, especially, which corgis also get disc disease. Mm-hmm. Degenerative myelopathy is a disease we can actually test, do some genetic testing for to find out if they're going to get that or not. It's a disease where the spinal cord just kind of falls apart. So they lose function, neurologic function in their back end as they age. So it's an unfortunate thing for corgis, but that's why we like to test, do genetic testing on dogs to find out, you know, are they carriers for this? Are they going to get it? Are they not going to get it? So should we be breeding them?
So is it more genetics than prone to specific breeds?
Yes, I think it is genetics, but those specific breeds all share similar genetic patterns anyway. Those what are called chondrodysplastic breeds are those short, long dogs, the dachshunds, the beagles, the basset hounds.
But you know, it's getting difficult to get into a veterinary clinic around here. It's almost as bad as getting in to see a doctor.
Worse.
Yeah, or sometimes worse. Maybe we'll get a little relief from that. We'll get the information from Dr. Jevon Clark about that after this.
Well, we have personnel shortages all over the valley in every sector, it seems like. We have Dr. Jevon Clark here from the Animal Clinic of Kalispell. You mentioned human categories. I waited 2.5 months to get an eye checkup because my eyes were bothering me. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's cataracts and macular degeneration. Well, thanks. Didn't want to rush into anything here. So it's probably the same way. If your dog or your cat is ill, you'd like to get in.
Yeah.
And you mentioned we have a doctor shortage in veterinary care.
Yeah, it's not just here. Like, it is, as everybody that has pets knows, it is really difficult to get in right now. I mean, we and every other veterinarian that I know of in the valley is booked out forever. And so it is a challenge because we're trying to do our best to get all the urgent care stuff that happens. Yeah. I mean, you can't predict that. So we've changed some things in our schedule to be able to see more urgent care stuff, but that then it pushes out the wellness stuff, you know, all the stuff that, because we tell people, man, we really need to see this cat, you know, 2 months ago, and we still can't see it for two more months just for wellness stuff, to check its thyroid, to check its kidneys. And so it's actually a nationwide problem. It's not just Kalispell. It's not just Montana. It's everywhere. But and it's really stressful, honestly, we know it's stressful for our patients. It's stressful for our clients. It's stressful for our staff because we want to take care of them.
And full service. As far as the Animal Clinic of Kalispell goes, any relief in sight?
Yeah, we are really blessed that we have at least one new doctor, if not two, coming in. One starting in about a month, November 1st. And what that means for our patients is that hopefully we are going to have less wait time on stuff. Yeah. And as people come here, as people, you know, move to the valley, it's just gotten even worse as far as trying to get in. And so we're hoping as this kind of pushes through that we'll be able to offer some relief for some people. And, you know, I think that's one of the struggles, and this happens in human medicine too. What happens is, so you can't get in, you know, your pet is sick, you can't get in. So everything ends up being quote unquote urgent, you know, so you're running through urgent care kinds of things, which it's great. I mean, we need urgent care stuff, obviously, but you know, if you have, your dog has an ear infection, is that really an urgent thing other than, if we can't get them in for 4 weeks, then it does become urgent. So we're hoping that we can put a little bit of a notch in that.
Yeah. So. What about telemedicine for animals? Is that a thing?
Yeah, it is a thing. I have no idea how on earth it works. Yeah. Like how, for me, the biggest skill set is being able to have that pet in front of me and touch it. and see and use all my senses. And like, I don't know how you feel a dog's belly through the phone.
Feel the dog's belly. Yeah, what does it feel like?
Yeah. You know? Or is this cat have a urinary tract obstruction? Ooh. How do I know that if I'm not standing there in front of it? So I don't really know how it works.
Yeah.
I don't.
But as far as like ear infection or something like that, it's probably fairly obvious. Can you give advice on treatment?
Exactly. Sometimes it's obvious, but that doesn't solve the problem of that. You know, ears and eyes are a good example. So you have a dog that clearly has an ear infection. Well, all right. Now you have to, in order to get the thing diagnosed, you need to know what's growing in there. So that you can't do that on the phone, and you need to know, what's the deep canal look like? Like, is his eardrum intact? We don't know that. What medication should you use? Which bug is in there? Like, is it going to be, do we need this drug or do we need this drug? Those are things you just don't know. Well, that's why I said, I don't know how it works.
Good news.
I mean, you don't take the dog's blood pressure when they come in, do you?
We have, yes.
That's one of those things telemedicine can do.
Yeah,
I can check your blood pressure, but you can't very well do that with your dog.
Yeah, no, you cannot do it at a home for darn sure.
Yeah. So, is the nose wet?
Yeah,
you know that there's one sign.
Exactly. Right. So yeah, I think telemedicine definitely has its place. I think where it has its place, honestly, is if you get good qualified people to be answering the phones. Like, is this something that at 2 a.m. is this something you need to go get seen right now, or is this something you can wait on?
Yeah. All right. Boy, great conversation this morning and a lot of great information.
Thank you, guys.
Dr. Jevin Clark. We appreciate it.